B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, October 30th, 2017. Big news inside the Beltway as special counsel Bob Mueller unseals the indictment of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his partner Davis. And a little surprise garnish with a plea deal from a low-level Trump campaign staffer. And before we begin, on a personal note, I want to dedicate this podcast to the memory of Gilmer Totten. Gil Totten was one of my uncles, and I had quite a few. 10 survived into adulthood, who I got to know. And he was really one of my favorites, the coolest guy at the family reunions and the holiday parties. And he himself fathered 12 children, many of whom I am very close to this day. And his passing leaves his widow, my Aunt Laura Jean, as the only survivor of that generation, my parents' generation. So I'm a little saddened to share that news with you, but Gil was a great guy, and I will certainly miss him. Now, the big news today, as I headlined, is about Robert Mueller going to work and unsealing the indictments. And I'm going to dive into that in some detail. I've included links to the indictment and to the plea deal so that you can read them for yourselves. But I want to begin by framing this properly. And Joe Lauria, who is a frequent contributor to this program, a guy who's covered the United Nations for many years and is a talented international independent journalist. He's also the author of the book Why I Lost by Hillary Clinton. And I know that title is a little misleading, but what Joe did was write annotations to commentary that came from the candidate herself that explains, in Lauria's view, why she lost. But today's article is a think piece that's published at consortiumnews.com, headlined The Democratic Money Behind Russiagate. Let me read the opening paragraph here. The two sources that originated the allegations claiming that Russia meddled in the 2016 election without providing convincing evidence were both paid for by the Democratic National Committee and, in one instance, also by the Clinton campaign, the Steele dossier, and the CrowdStrike analysis of the DNC servers. And he says, think about that for a minute. And I hope you'll think even longer and click on the link in today's show file to read this article yourself. He goes on, we have long known that the DNC didn't allow the FBI to examine its computer server for clues about who may have hacked or leaked that information, and instead turned to CrowdStrike, a private company co-founded by a virulently anti-Putin Russian. Within a day, CrowdStrike blamed Russia on dubious evidence. And last week, it was acknowledged that the Clinton campaign and the DNC paid for the opposition research memos written by former British intelligence agent Christopher Steele, using hearsay accusations from anonymous Russian sources to claim that the Russian government was blackmailing and bribing Trump in a scheme that presupposed that Russian President Putin foresaw Trump's presidency years ago when no one else did. In other words, says Lauria, possibly all the Russiagate allegations, which have been taken on faith by Democratic partisans and members of the anti-Trump resistance, trace back to claims paid for or generated by Democrats. Think about that for an hour or two. And so I really do encourage you to read this, because Lauria very objectively and systematically explains how these are concoctions of the Democratic campaign. And one of the critical bits that is being glossed over and misreported from comedians like Bill Maher to many others who comment on this is that Christopher Steele was not hired to write opposition research for Fusion GPS, the Washington-based firm, until after the Clinton allies started paying for the research. And I've heard claims that it was $9 million, it was $12 million. We know that the Perkins Coie law firm received a total of $12 million for the legal work of Mark Elias. Elias retained Fusion GPS, perhaps to use an attorney-client privilege to prevent us from finding that out. And the DNC and the Clinton campaign paid a total of $12 million. Now, I can't verify this, but I heard Rush Limbaugh assert this morning that the Obama for America campaign committee also paid $1 million to Perkins Coie or Fusion GPS. He was a little fuzzy on that. I report that just to be fair. It may or may not be provable, but that's what is being fed to right-wing radio listeners. So when you look at this picture and you see that the FBI and the CIA got wind of what Steele was doing, we know at a certain point John McCain got wind of it and went to London, got some documents and turned them over to the FBI. And all along the way, the Clinton campaign was feeding this stuff of dubious credibility to media outlets who refused to run it. Now, I'm happily surprised to report that. But Laria goes on here, if in fact the Steele memos were a primary basis for Russian collusion, the allegations against Trump, then there may be no credible evidence at all. It could be that because the three agencies knew the dossier, that's the people who wrote the intelligence assessments that were revealed in October and in January, he says that because the three agencies knew the dossier was dodgy, that there was no substantive proof in the January 6th assessment. Even so, a summary of the Steele allegations were included in a secret appendix that the then FBI Director James Comey described to President-elect Trump just 2 weeks before the inauguration. Now, in the old days, we would say, well, that's just J. Edgar Hoover welcoming a new leader to Washington by saying, I've got dirt on you, so don't cross me. So I want you to think seriously about this as we dive into the coverage of the Manafort indictments, the Papadopoulos plea deal. Ah, but there's one more element to keep in mind. It was revealed over the weekend that the Republican donor who used a Washington-based nonprofit media outlet called the Free Beacon to pay Fusion GPS for Phase 1. That's the research done on Trump that didn't involve Steele that was conducted during the Republican primaries. And the funder is billionaire vulture capitalist Paul Singer, based in New York and a major focus of the work of Greg Palast. If you have followed his exposés of election manipulation, voter suppression by Republican operatives, including Chris Kobach, he is a major player. And so that is an important bit to understand about the origins of all of this stuff. So I'm relying primarily today on the Washington Post for the narrative of the revelation, the unsealing of the indictments against Manafort and Rick Davis, and the surprise announcement of the plea deal for lying to investigators related to foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos. Now, we've already heard about Papadopoulos, and as we'll delve into in a moment, the Washington Post frames this as marking the first criminal allegations to come from probes into possible Russian influence in U.S. political affairs. But when it describes the plea deal with Papadopoulos, they say it described extensive efforts by him to try to broker connections with Russian officials and arrange a meeting between them and the Trump campaign, though some emails show his offers were rebuffed. Well, that is a major qualifier that we will detail in a moment. So, Papadopoulos was picked up at Dulles Airport on July 27th, which was when he was charged, and that was kept secret until now. It appears that the dramatic timing is a tactic being used by Special Counsel Bob Mueller. And the indictment of Manafort and Davis can be amended, but so far it doesn't assert anything related to the election cycle last year. It all goes from 2015 backward. And Trump was quick to point that out in tweets this morning. So there's less here than meets the eye. But I don't try to say that there is nothing here. And I'm already prepared for the hype that Rachel Maddow will apply to this when I watch her show tonight, so that some of you don't have to. At any rate, Papadopoulos signed a plea agreement that indicates he is cooperating and that he got caught in a series of lies as he tried to claim that some of his contacts with Russians or Russian-related individuals predated his ascent to the Trump campaign. And he's a nobody. All right, he was an intern at the Hudson Institute, and somehow he glommed on to Trump with a padded resume. And was Trump was pressed to name some of his foreign policy advisors, he mentioned Papadopoulos and Carter Page, neither of whom has any currency in either domestic or international foreign policy circles. Now, the professor that Papadopoulos met in London and apparently in Italy has been identified as Joseph Mifsud, the director of the London Academy of Diplomacy. And in an email exchange in August, when this was first revealed, Mifsud told the Washington Post he had absolutely no contact with the Russian government. He's an academic whose only ties to Russia are through academic links. That may or may not be so. But in any event, the story told in the FBI plea deal is that Papadopoulos met this guy who wasn't interested in him until he told him he was working on the Trump campaign. Then he became very interested, and this is portrayed as, number one, Papadopoulos lying to downplay the connection. But number two, this is a contact that our intelligence people became aware of. And it was part of the concern that we've been told surfaced with John Brennan at the CIA and Director of National Intelligence and proven perjurer, DNI, James Clapper. So also, this is kind of a footnote, but the Washington Post has previously reported that Sergey Millian, M-I-L-L-I-A-N, was a key source of information contained in the Steele dossier about Trump's ties to Russia, told people around him that he was in contact with Papadopoulos during the campaign. So that's worrisome, that's potentially incriminating, and that is an avenue that Mueller might exploit to produce some evidence of real collusion. And I'm prepared, by the way, to accept any real evidence that surfaces. I want to be clear about that. My skepticism is based on the lack of evidence and the way the corporate media has gotten way ahead of the limited evidence available based on leaks, anonymous sources, and a whole lot of speculation that is used to stitch certain facts together. So let's look at the pushback at the from internal members of the Trump campaign. When Papadopoulos repeatedly sent emails and said, hey, I can arrange a meeting with Russians. We could even arrange a meeting between Trump and Putin. So, one advisor, Navy Rear Admiral Charles Kubik, reminded others about legal restrictions on meetings with Russian officials, adding, just want to make sure that no one on the team outruns their headlights and embarrasses the campaign. And we know that Manafort himself, when he saw emails from Papadopoulos, that he pushed back and said that he wanted this stopped and that he wanted some low-level campaigner to address the situation so that other problems didn't surface. And that does draw a minimal mention in the narrative by the Post, which then goes on just to go Trump, Russia, Trump, Russia, Trump, Russia. So the key elements that Papadopoulos is accused of lying about are that this British professor contacted him before he worked on the campaign, and that a woman that he mistakenly thought was the niece of Vladimir Putin met him during the campaign and not before, and he lied about it. And also, he lied about being told that there was dirt on Clinton, and he had falsely claimed that that contact was before he started working on the campaign. So here's the quote from Manafort. This is on May 21st. Papadopoulos emails a high-ranking campaign official, likely to be Manafort, informing him, Russia has been eager to meet Mr. Trump for quite some time and have been reaching out to me to discuss. So he's pumping up his own importance as a conduit here. So Manafort forwards that to his partner and now co-defendant, Rick Gates. "We need someone to communicate that Trump is not doing these trips. It should be someone low level in the campaign so as not to send any signal." That's an inconvenient email statement from Paul Manafort. Keep it in mind because it may come into play as all of this evolves. So this, again, you know, I think is very interesting. It's certainly dramatic. It commands a lot of attention. But it doesn't really advance the Trump-Russia narrative that's been promoted by Democrats and by friendly media partners like Rachel Maddow. So now let's take a look at the 12-count indictment against Manafort and Gates. And as I mentioned, I've linked to it in the show file. It's on the Washington Post website with some commentary, and you can get a look at it. But fundamentally, they are being accused of making $75 million, mostly from Ukraine, during the presidency of Viktor Yanukovych, who is, by the way, corrupt, but was properly elected, for the most part, under the corrupt system in Ukraine. And he was ousted in a U.S.-backed coup in about 2014, and that exposed a lot, including a ledger that showed Manafort had received cash payments. And so this shows that Manafort was a greedy guy who made a boatload of money promoting a corrupt but properly elected leader of Ukraine. And it shows that the $75 million includes at least $18 million that was very carefully laundered through offshore companies and bank accounts, and the money was wired into the United States to pay vendors, to pay for real estate. And then Manafort made loans against the real estate in the United States to free up cash that had not been subject to any kind of reporting or taxation. So essentially, Manafort and Davis are accused of defrauding the United States, mostly in the form of the Internal Revenue Service. He also lied to his accountants, who presented information to the IRS that has now been shown to be false by the special counsel's investigation. The other critical issue is that Manafort lobbied for Ukraine without registering as a foreign lobbyist, and he channeled money through wire transfers, at least $2 million, to two unnamed firms in Washington, D.C., who actually did the lobbying. And their nominal client was the a Belgian-based entity called the European Center for Modern Ukraine. We'll just call that the center for any future reference. So the center wired money to firm A and firm B in Washington, D.C. We know that one of those firms was the Podesta Group, which John Podesta says he helped start but was not involved in or receiving any profits from, while his brother Tony ran the firm. Podesta was busy at the Center for American Progress and running Hillary Clinton's campaigns. And for the moment, I'll accept that John Podesta had no direct connection to the Podesta group at the time that they were lobbying for Ukraine. But they were working with a Republican, Paul Manafort, who was wiring them money from a Belgian account. And so that is pretty much the long and the short of this indictment. Again, I encourage you to read it so that you can get a feel for what the charges are. And I think it's highly likely that Manafort and Davis will be convicted or take some sort of a plea deal. So here comes Donald Trump tweeting, "Sorry, but this is years ago, before Manafort was part of the Trump campaign. But why aren't crooked Hillary and the Dems the focus?" Well, somebody should explain to this guy with orange hair and the bad comb over that Mueller has not been tasked to investigate Hillary Clinton. And it's a long stretch to say that Christopher Steele and the dirty dossier were part of some Russian plot. I have my own problems, as you know, with the way the Hillary Clinton campaign was run and many of the self-inflicted wounds. But Trump felt the compulsion to follow up that tweet 3 minutes later. Also, there is no collusion. Now, Trump is accurate. There is no collusion over the election alleged in the Manafort indictments. And Papadopoulos is being accused of lying to investigators. Perhaps they'll get him to sing about collusion, but it is not asserted. I read every page of the plea deal. It is not asserted so far. Then we look at the corporate media response to all this. A think piece at the Washington Post, which is purporting to explain all this to us, says, well, at the very least, accusations that the Trump campaign worked with Russia are not a hoax. Really? Money laundering, tax evasion by Manafort with Ukraine? That's not Russia. Ukraine is a former part of the Soviet Union. It is not Russia. And geographically challenged Americans, I think, will largely fall for that bait. The Post went on to say it's worth significant time and resources for three committees in Congress and the independent investigation to continue. I'm all in favor of the investigations. But don't draw conclusions or reject conclusions before the evidence is in. Then the one quote I have here from the New York Times on this today relates to the FBI raid that was conducted pre-dawn with no knock on Manafort's residence in July. And one of the claims that Manafort had made to investigators was, well, my firm has a document destruction policy, and we shred everything after 30 days. Well, that's apparently a lie, because the search in July revealed numerous documents related to lobbying, which were more than 30 days old. So that's a problem for Manafort. But again, it doesn't have any real linkage to the claim that Russia meddled in our election cycle last year. And an interesting story a couple of days ago in the New York Times, Dateline Kiev. Corruption is still a serious problem in Ukraine and has led to public protests in Maidan Square. Corruption is flourishing. Nothing has changed, said a war veteran who is one of the protesters. And this is what's really interesting. You know that the current president of Ukraine is Petro Poroshenko. He is a billionaire who made his money in sugar, in candy. And this past year, I think it was over the summer, the former and discredited president of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, who has been an ally of Poroshenko, is now a main backer of the protest camp in the capital of Ukraine. And he even spent the night in a sleeping bag with the other protesters one night last week. Poroshenko has revoked the Ukrainian citizenship it granted him in better days. And he is now a stateless, homeless individual. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Pauline Nixon, Hillary Hamilton, and Perry Productions just renewed their annual subscriptions. Thank you both. And Susan Lewis, who is a regular subscriber, and I've been told that we've helped convert her conservative husband to a more progressive point of view. Thanks to each and every one of you. If you'd like to make a new subscription, I'd love you to take one out. Just go to peterbcollins.com and follow the links to the sign-up page. And I want to note, you can always send a one-time contribution, and if you don't like PayPal, you can send subscription funds to my new P.O. Box. It's Box 150660, San Rafael, California, 94915. That's Box 150660, San Rafael, California, 94915. And I do appreciate your support. That really ugly single-source deal in Puerto Rico to repair the power grid and restore electrical service that was granted to a two-person company based in Montana called Whitefish Energy Holdings, it's going to be scrapped. And the embarrassed head of the public utility there, Ricardo Ramos, went public after a weekend visit by Senator Bernie Sanders, who urged that this obviously corrupt deal be canceled. And it is going to be canceled, but there will be a transition that's going to delay the rewiring and re-electrification of Puerto Rico by an estimated 10 to 12 weeks. That's really awful. And here in the Bay Area, where we're still recovering from the wildfires, last night I went up with some friends to patronize my buddy Rob Larman's restaurant called Cochon Volant, French for the flying pig. Well, I got to survey some of the fire damage, and boy, it is devastating. One of my favorite wineries, the B. R. Cohn Winery, started by Bruce Cohn, the former manager of the Doobie Brothers. He's probably still manager. I don't want to push him out. Anyway, his property was unscathed, but the area just to the north, on his property line to the north, was scorched completely. And I saw the kind of burnout cars that many of you have seen and the kind of moonscape scenes that are really devastating. So our rogue electric utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, is already agitating to shift the cost of these wildfires to us, the ratepayers, before the investigators have even determined who caused the fire and who is liable for it. And it gets into legal issues related to what's called inverse condemnation. And essentially, if my home burned down and I can assert that the electric utility caused it, well, they're going to have to pay for my lost property. And you know that insurance companies representing homeowners will look to the deep pockets of the utility to try to avoid paying off claims. So this is going to be a round robin of problems, and unfortunately, it all leads back to the California Public Utilities Commission, which under Governor Jerry Brown has been permitted to really enable the fleecing of ratepayers by the utilities instead of protecting consumers as the agency is designed to do. Trump got another legal setback as a federal court is blocking his August memo, which was to ban the service of transgender persons in the U.S. military. Now, this lawsuit will continue, but it does put on hold that very aggressive homophobic or sexual phobic, I don't know the right way to perfectly describe it, but it was just an ugly pandering to the Twitter base of the president, and the court has rejected it. I've known for many years that Kevin Spacey is gay, that he drinks a lot, that he hits on other men around him. And last night at midnight, Kevin Spacey apologized to child actor, who's now much older, Anthony Rapp, for a sexual advance that he made on him more than 30 years ago. And this is really bizarre because in responding to an allegation of sexual assault, all triggered, of course, by Harvey Weinstein, Spacey said he is beyond horrified to hear Rapp's story, but he doesn't remember it. However, he apologized if I did behave then, as Rapp describes, for what would have been deeply inappropriate drunken behavior. Now, what I find interesting about this is that he uses this occasion to finally come out. This story has encouraged me to address other things about my life. I have loved and had romantic encounters with men throughout my life, and I choose now to live as a gay man. Now? I want to deal with this honestly and openly, and that starts with examining my own behavior. Now, my source is a friend who has been a director on some of the House of Cards episodes. And he privately described Spacey as very difficult to work with, showing up late, hungover, demanding that the crew go into overtime because of his work habits, and yes, routinely hitting on younger men in his company. Now, the creator of House of Cards, Bo Willimon, says, "During the time I worked with Kevin Spacey on House of Cards, I neither witnessed nor was aware of any inappropriate behavior on set or off." That is a questionable denial. On Friday, the parliament in Barcelona took a fateful vote for independence for Catalonia from Spain. Spain responded by taking direct control of Catalonia and dismissing the leadership. And I note that the vote on Friday was done with secret ballot, But that doesn't prevent Madrid from identifying the leaders and supporters of the independence movement who are now facing charges of sedition. It's going to be ugly and messy. There was a huge protest march in Barcelona yesterday with upwards of 300,000 people supporting staying with Spain. So this is clearly a very, very divisive and contentious issue that has not been resolved. And finally today, I want to say farewell to Dennis Banks, the militant Chippewa who helped found the American Indian Movement back in 1968. He had a very checkered story. Grew up in poverty, alcoholism, did some time in jail. And I first met Dennis Banks when he and other AIM members, including Russell Means, were occupying a monastery in Gresham, Wisconsin. And I was a 20, 21-year-old cub reporter from Chicago. I drove up there one weekend and interviewed them. It was scary and an early interesting experience for me. But Banks went on to lead the charge to generate better treatment for Native Americans. He was part of the occupation at Wounded Knee, also at Alcatraz here on San Francisco Bay. And a much younger Jerry Brown, when he was governor the first time, granted asylum to Dennis Banks in 1976 to prevent his extradition to South Dakota to face charges in the Wounded Knee case. And he stayed here until Brown left the governorship, and he then went elsewhere, ultimately did turn himself in, and did about 14 months for his involvement in the Wounded Knee occupation. Happy trails to Dennis Banks. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's free, and you're free to share it with absolutely everybody. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.